Okay, good morning. I hope you are having a nice time in Girona. Today we have the second day of this workshop, and the first speaker will be Richard Wright. Professor Richard Wright is a professor at Chicago Kent College of Law, and he's also a member of the American Law Institute, and he has worked mainly in subjects of causation in tort law and substantive theories of tort law, like corrective justice, and has maintains famous debates with authors like Jules Coleman and Ernest Wenrebaum on this subject. Today he's going to talk about just liability given indeterminate causation.
Thank you. I've actually reorganized my talk to make it a treatise on footnote 37. And if you'll recall footnote 37, it says from Mike and Joe, science is less about knowledge than about an accepted process for conditionally accepting theories or explanations of natural phenomena as true. Those processes are not invoked to answer the kinds of questions the law requires in a tort case. And then goes on to say, while some scientific disciplines address other matters that bear circumstantially on that question, none inquire into the ultimate factual issue of individual causation. So I think the footnote was meant to address more the issue of specific causation rather than general, but it's phrased as addressing general as well. And then later on page 19, there's no accepted scientific methodology for determining the cause of an individual disease. Well, I think that that's not correct, that science is about knowledge. We use certain processes to try and acquire that knowledge, but certainly science is about knowledge, about trying to learn about how the world works. So when I talk about causation, I'm only talking about natural causation, scientific causation, causation in fact, those sort of terms. And obviously science is all about trying to learn the laws of nature. And we have to use that, you know, we use that knowledge to, that's what we're trying to do actually when we try and establish general causation. In a tort case, we're trying to rely upon the methods that science uses, the best ones we can, and unfortunately we often can't use the best ones to try and establish, is this a law of nature? Can this sort of exposure cause this sort of disease or harm? So we use the processes of science to try and gain knowledge about causal laws. And then we use our knowledge of those causal laws to try and identify specific instances of causation. You know, that's what we have to do. So I think that, you know, it's clear that science is very relevant for both the issue of general causation and specific causation. Now, and I think in the area of scientific, you know, statistics and stuff and so forth, epidemiology, that we often talk about causal laws, we use the word mechanisms instead of causal laws, but I think it's the same idea from when I talk to epidemiologists. You know, what are the actual processes, the actual laws of nature? And to focus on that, we need to know what is the nature of a causal law. Well, I think this goes back to John Stuart Mill, you know, in his System of Logic. I think he's still in many, many ways the best discussion of this, that a causal law is really an empirically derived statement that says that if you have this set of antecedent conditions that are all instantiated in a particular situation, that all actually occur in a particular situation, that invariably this specific result will immediately follow, right? So we kind of, you know, learn by experience, by experimentation and so forth, that these sorts of things that all occur will produce this. Now, ordinarily, we don't have complete knowledge of all the elements of causal law. We use causal generalizations. We kind of say, and even if we had all the knowledge, we often wouldn't refer to all the elements. It would require a huge, huge list to refer to all the elements, negative and positive. So we refer to kind of the ones that are only kind of most, you know, questionable from the standpoint of what we're discussing right now, or most obvious. So we have these causal generalizations, right? And again, how do we learn about those? Well, we learn about it through, you know, the sort of things that Bradford Hill talks about, that Susan Hack talks about, you know, through actual experiments. Mill called it the difference method, right? You kind of sort of say, you know, if this is part of the element of the antecedent part of a causal law, and it's kind of necessary to make this be sufficient, then if we remove it, then the result shouldn't follow. So we kind of test by the difference method whether this is one of the required elements in this abstract causal law. And by the way, sort of an aside, let me point out that the basic idea of causation, unlike the usual but-for test of necessity, is sufficiency, right? The idea of causation is that there is this set of conditions that's sufficient to produce this. And any actual condition that is part of the instantiation of one of these elements in the antecedent set of conditions is a part of the cause. It's, you know, some of you may be familiar with that as the nest test idea, right? The necessary element of a sufficient set. And we do have to make sure when we're describing the causal law that we include in this description of antecedent conditions only conditions that are necessary for the sufficiency of the set. But when we're actually investigating actual instances of causation, we don't have to actually use that necessity element anymore. It's already built into the causal law. All we have to say is this is part of the instantiation of one of the elements. Doesn't have to be a complete instantiation of it. We may have, you know, we may need three drops of poison. One person puts in two, one person puts in one, right? Or we may have only need three drops and one person puts in three, another person puts in six. You know, it doesn't matter if we have more than we need unless that somehow knocks out something else that we need to have as part of a sufficient set. So the basic idea of causation is sufficiency, not necessity. And if you think about it, even when you use the but-for test, the sine qua non test, you're really, at least implicitly in your mind, you're using a sufficiency test. You're saying, you know, if I remove this, if I set it aside, this particular condition, are all the other existing conditions still sufficient to produce this? It's still a sufficiency analysis, even when you use the but-for test. So that's the basic idea of causation. And so we try and acquire that knowledge through, you know, actual experiments, toxicology and so forth. We're limited in doing that on human beings by ethical constraints and so forth. So we try and use animals, we try and extrapolate from that. We use epidemiology to try and kind of say, well, you know, that's a rough way of using the difference method to try and sort of say, given different combinations of things, what happens, what's the increase in risk. I think there's a misunderstanding here about even epidemiology and increased risk is that what it really gives you is the increased risk of, you know, let's say we have, you know, substance A and substance B, right? And we kind of try and measure, okay, here's how often it occurs with substance A. If we add substance B, what's the increased risk? Well, that would give us a good idea of the relative causal potency of these two things if you ignore overdetermination, right? So, I mean, the idea that you require, for example, a minimum probability of, you know, increase in risk of at least, you know, 100%, you know, relative risk greater than 2, ignores the fact that you can have a situation where they both overlap and cause sometimes that's overdetermined. So, for example, if you had, I don't know, a situation where you have 10 incidents, right? Our population of incidents of the result is 10. It could be that in 3 of those, let's say it's smoking and, you know, and asbestos for cancer, for example. 3 of them maybe were caused only by smoking. 3 of them were caused only by cancer. 4 were caused by both. It's overdetermined. Now, on those numbers, it means that out of these 10, 7 of them were caused by smoking, 3 all by itself, 4 overdetermined. 70% of them were caused by smoking. Same thing for the asbestos. 70% were caused by asbestos. And yet, if you use this relative risk idea, the increase in incidents due to one combined to the other is only 3 out of 10. So you would kind of say that's not large enough to be to show a more than doubling of the risk. But that would ignore the fact of overdetermination. So given the possibility of overdetermination, unless you can eliminate that, you have to say that the increased risk number given to you by epidemiology is a lower bound. It's a lower bound. It doesn't state the exact number. It's a lower bound. It could be much higher than that in terms of what the actual relative risk is if there's overdetermination. So once more, like Michael, I'll get back on topic here. The way we kind of do this, you know, in through epidemiology, we can actually learn a lot by epidemiology, even though it's not direct experimentation. And it's the reference class sort of idea, right? The more you kind of subdivide this thing into more and more discrete reference classes, the better information you get. But if you have very broad reference classes, this is not very good for a particular case, right? People have talked about, well, what about the genetics of this individual? So when we try and use an overall class-based statistic to try and argue about what happened in this case, it gives a probability only for the class as a whole, for the average person in that class as that class is defined, which may not accurately at all and usually does not define this individual who has different genetics, different circumstances in different sorts of ways. So to say that this probability for the class as a whole represents a probability for this individual of causation usually is not at all true, right? But the more you try and specify and more make it more a specific reference class of this individual, you know, the more you kind of get this down to eventually probabilities of zero or one. Once you've identified every relevant characteristic, you've now gotten down to either zero or one probability. You've now defined the causal law. You know, so there's this problem with, you know, the use of statistics is that they depend, they're taken as kind of given really good numbers in cases when there's very little attention paid to how much they actually fit this particular case, and they never actually fit this particular case individually. There's also the problem, of course, of reliability. Many of them are very poorly done. There's a sort of similar debate about the use of Bayes' theorem in a different sort of way. I think I mentioned yesterday that there is upset by forensic statisticians in the United Kingdom that a court there recently kind of said you can't use Bayes' theorem unless you really kind of prove really reliable beginning base points for the use of the theorem. And this upset the chairman of the Royal Statistical Society Working Group on Statistics and the Law, says it's usual for forensic experts to use Bayes' theorem even when data is limited by making assumptions and then drawing up reasonable estimates of what the numbers might be. Being unable to do this could risk miscarriages of justice. From being quite precise and being able to quantify your uncertainty, you've got to give a completely bland statement and say maybe, maybe not, no numbers. But he's kind of upset he can't use numbers he's made up as conveying accuracy and, you know, and true information. I mean, it's just really bizarre. But the real problem, I think, with the use of statistics to try and establish specific causation, you know, there's no question you can use epidemiology. It's often, you know, a useful tool, not the only tool. We all know you have to kind of add on all the sort of things about to make it not merely a coincidental association, a causal association, the Bradford Hill criteria, Susan Hack's, you know, criteria and so forth. Which emphasize biological plausibility. You know, to what extent does this sort of fit with the laws of nature that we know about? And how as reliable as each individual sort of thing we're kind of adding up here, what's the overall sort of fit of the overall evidence with our knowledge of biological processes, causal laws, and how comprehensive is the data, right? So, and I think that's a very good sort of test in doing this. Now, the real problem is you cannot establish specific causation using statistics. I argue they're actually irrelevant on the specific causation issue, no matter how high they are, right? Epidemiology is relevant and useful in establishing, in predicting what might happen, in saying after something has happened, what was most likely given the statistics of how often this occurs due to this, you know, ignoring all the problems about generally how imprecise this number is for this particular case, how it doesn't really fit it. But they can never tell you what actually happened in this case. Because even if you have a situation that 90% of the time this is due to this exposure, that means 10% of the time it's not. And you have no way of knowing whether it's one of the 90% or one of the 10%. I mean, doctors know that. They will never testify in court, I know this is what caused it. They can kind of tell you, I can tell you what the odds are, but I won't tell you this is actually what caused it. I can't tell you. And even the Supreme Court, the UK Supreme Court in Sienkiewicz said, every judge, including Phillips, says, you cannot use the statistics to establish actual causation, right? As a matter of actual scientific proof, you can't do it. You can't go from the statistics, unless it's 100%, to say that that's what happened in this case. Because all you know is that most of the time it happens in this way, but some of the times it doesn't. The statistics tell you nothing about where this case fits in in an actual individual instance. Let's say even when the numbers are very high, if you have a roulette wheel, and the odds are very low, it will end up in this particular place or combination. And somehow it's spun, and then before anybody can kind of record where it landed, everything goes dark. Nobody's going to pay off on that bet. You tell them the odds were 99% against you. You lost. Pay off. Nobody's going to pay off on that bet unless they kind of have specific information to this case to say how it turned out. So you have to have, so how do you actually prove what happened in this case? How you actually prove what happened in a particular case is by instantiating the elements of the causal law. So we have competing stories here. 90% of the time it happens this way, 10% of the time it happens this way. Or we don't know maybe what the other 10% is, right? We either have competing causal stories or here's a story that 90% of the time is true. Well, what you have to do to say what happened in this case is you have to have evidence specific to this case, often called particularistic evidence, specific to this case that instantiates and fills in the elements of that causal law. It's only in that way you're able to kind of say that the more I have elements that in this particular case fill in the elements of this causal law and the antecedent plus the result, the more I come to believe. It's a belief function, right? Not a probability function. The more I come to believe what actually happened in this case. And you do that in the same way that Susan talks about, right? But now the specific structure that you have to fit it into is the structure of this causal law. And often it's more than one causal law, a certain set of causal laws in this case. How well does this fit in terms of direct and circumstantial evidence? And circumstantial evidence is, again, it's often misunderstood, but it also is concrete evidence in this case. But it's not direct evidence of the sort of specific thing you're trying to prove. It's circumstantial. The guy was running away from the scene with a knife that kind of fits the knife wound with blood dripping that meets the other person's blood. It's all particularistic. It's not direct observation, or direct proof of, I'm stabbing right now. But it's part of this overall story that if this is what happened, then in addition to the sort of main line of the story, the main thing you're trying to prove, a whole bunch of other things you would expect to go along with that or would be explained in light of that. So we look at all that direct and circumstantial evidence and say, to what extent does this evidence about what happened in this case allow us to fill in enough of the actual elements of the abstract causal law or laws or generalizations to say that I'm now as kind of this has been filled in enough, and if there's competing stories, the other story has been filled in so little or maybe even ruled out by one of its elements clearly not existing, to say that I've reached a point. It's a psychological belief point, probably varies for each individual. I've reached this point where I believe this is actually what happened. Now we have in the law different degrees of belief, right? We have sort of notions of how high a belief do you have to prove in different types of cases. Well, beyond a reasonable doubt, clear and convincing, or a minimal belief, right? And I think usually in a civil case, the idea is, and it's often misunderstood as being statistical, preponderance of the evidence, is a minimal belief. Just barely a form of belief, this is what happened, unlike criminal law beyond a reasonable doubt or in between clear and convincing. But how do you reach that belief? You reach it by the sort of things that Susan talks about. You now have to kind of find, in this particular case, you have to kind of find the evidence, direct and indirect, all supports this particular story. And the more it supports it, the better. The individual elements are reliable. And we can use statistics to kind of say how reliable a particular element is, right? Eyewitness testimony and so on. But even there, we tend to look more at the particular things going on in this particular case. The witness's demeanor, their reputation for honesty. I mean, we kind of use all those sort of things, whether or not they're inconsistent or consistent in their testimony. We tend to focus more on that than we do overall statistics, in general, on average, about eyewitness testimony being reliable. We try and figure out how reliable is this person using those same factors of, fit, coherence, comprehensiveness, and so forth, to say whether or not this particular, bit of evidence we think is reliable. But we combine these bits of evidence not in a probabilistic mathematical probability way. We combine them instead by this idea of how well do they fit, coherence, a degree of belief in fit. And, Jonathan Cohen pointed out a long time ago that if you try and use the mathematical probability idea of, you know, statistics and so on in this area, there's all sorts of paradoxes generated. When we try and prove a particular, for example, tort case, we say we have to prove duty and breach and damages and causation, and we don't multiply the probabilities, figure out probabilities of each of those individually and multiply them together. If we did, you can never prove anything. If you proved every element to it, you know, let's say we had 70% confidence in each of these elements, would be certainly enough for a jury to find liability. You multiply 0.7 times 0.7 times 0.7 times 0.7. After the first two, you're already down to below 50%, 0.49. It's not what we do. The negation paradox that he talks about, the gate crasher hypothetical, you know, that, I mean, that's not the way we figure out what happened in a particular case. Mathematical probability is not what's going on in trying to figure out what actually happened in a particular case. It's what you use for prediction, right? But probability is not the same as belief. It's a whole different sort of system of how we go about doing it. Now, and if you see what lawyers do in actual cases, in court, what they do is they try and tell stories, right? They try and tell stories, and they try and kind of get you to believe this story I'm telling you is true. And you're going to believe that the more they kind of build up evidence that fits that story in this case. You're not going to believe it simply because the odds are, the guy walks in and kind of says, well, 70% of the time this guy runs the stop sign. Is that enough to prove he ran it in this case? No, wouldn't be enough. You know, so that's what's going on. But what we have is a problem. I think it came up really only in the U.S., although it spread a little bit to other countries, is even though this is, I think, generally understood, even by the court in Sienkiewicz, they're kind of saying, but, you know, we all understand you can't prove what actually happened in a particular case by probabilities and statistics, right? By general statistics. You can't prove what actually happened. It's a probability, doesn't tell you what actually happened. It's a class-based probability, tells you nothing about the particular case. Because a class-based probability does not instantiate a causal law. It tells you how often, generally, it will be fully instantiated, a generalization, if the elements of the causal generalization exist, but it gives you no information about, you know, were the rest of them actually instantiated in this particular case. And I think Susan did a nice job on this again in a paper she delivered here last year, I think, said that, you know, all of a sudden we came to, you know, to start to interpret, and I think for policy reasons, and the court in Sienkiewicz recognized this for policy reasons, started to recognize and try and treat preponderance of the evidence, because it's often said to be more likely than not, which is often said to be 50%+, as a mere probability standard, right? As a mere probability standard, not a belief standard. Even though the California code says it is a belief standard, right? It's a belief standard. It's not a probability, it's a belief standard. And talks about beyond a reasonable doubt, clear and convincing, and preponderance. And they talk about the weight of the evidence. Statistics don't have weight. Concrete evidence of a particular case have weight. They build up the story, right? But when the courts hit these toxic tort cases, and they're used to seeing all these references to preponderance, the evidence means more likely than not, you know, just 50%+, they took that as sort of a literal probability sort of standard. But if you look at a lot of these actual statements and instructions, it's more likely true than not, right? It's more likely convincing and true than not. It's a belief function, not a probability function. Now, but in the toxic tort cases, and we'll see also in medical, you know, in medical malpractice cases, courts being stymied by the inability to prove causation because we really don't know the mechanics, we don't know the processes. So in these cases, we're in a situation where maybe it caused it, maybe it didn't. Maybe a lot of the time it caused it, maybe most of the time it caused it, but you can't prove whether or not it did it in this case. So the courts were faced with a problem of, well, what do we do in these sort of cases? We kind of say, you haven't proved it, you're out of luck, or we kind of develop some sort of way of allowed recovery. And it looked kind of like pretty easy to say, we're not really changing the law very much. Maybe we don't even think we're changing the law by saying, well, if you can show more than a 50%+ statistical probability, if you can show a doubling of the risk, right, then you satisfy the preponderance of the evidence standard. Even more so in England, where it's stated as a balance of probability. It sounds even more like that, right? It's just a balance of probability. But the recent UK Supreme Court in Sienkiewicz said, no, that's not what it means, right? I mean, Phillips said, you know, as a matter of policy, I'm willing to accept that. Lord Brown kind of didn't say much of anything. All the rest of them, in varying degrees, said, no, you cannot use mere doubling of the risk to prove balance of probability. That's not what balance of probability means. It's a belief function. So we have this confusion about the burden of persuasion. I think that same thing hasn't happened in the civil law, because in the civil law, there really isn't a lot written about balance, burden of persuasion to begin with, and it's often described as a virtual sort of certainty, but it's very clear at the very least it is a belief function. That's very clear in the civil law, that you have to convince the judge, the trier of fact, the intime conviction standard in France, right? You have to kind of convince them by a, you know, there's language about convincing the trier of fact. It's a belief function in Germany, in the German civil and criminal code, right? So it's very clearly says a belief function. And the civil law courts have said, the Italian court has said, European Court of Human Rights say, it is not a mere probability test. No matter how high the probability, you cannot prove it based merely on statistics and probability. You have to have this concrete evidence that at very least ties those statistics to this particular case by instantiating the sort of story of how this actually happens. Well, but on the other hand, the courts kind of face this sort of problem of what do we do about this? And I think courts in the US, starting really not until the 1980s, in toxic tort cases, started kind of saying, well, we can take this doubling of the risk as satisfying the standard. And not as some sort of policy decision, but as this really kind of does establish it. Although I think even in Daubert on remand, I think that Kaczynski recognized in a footnote that this really is a legal policy choice, and it really doesn't establish what actually happens. And in fact, it leads to arbitrary results, right? Everybody recognizes that. So if you're at 50.1%, you get full recovery. If you're at 50% or 49.9, you get nothing. So this very, very small difference in statistical probability leads to zero or full recovery. There has to be something wrong about that, right? It can't be that all of a sudden our proof standards are such that, you know, that this really small difference in probability makes that huge a difference in liability. There's something wrong with that. Now, and I think even in the U.S., I mean, outside these toxic tort and medical malpractice areas, the courts don't interpret it that way. In the so-called naked statistics cases, you know, the blue bus sort of case, or the cases involving you own, 80% of the Hertz buses on the Hertz vehicles on the highway or something, or you supplied, 80% of the bolts to this manufacturer and there's a defective bolt, or a case in Oregon that out of two suppliers of DPT, you supplied 70% of the DPT. In every one of those cases, the court said, you cannot use that to establish causation in this case. The mere fact that it's a very high probability in a naked statistic sort of way cannot be used to establish what actually happened in this case. So, but when we kind of turn to the toxic tort cases, the courts have done that. When we turn to medical malpractice cases, the courts in the U.S. have said, a lot of them, if you can show that the loss chance was greater than 50%, you can recover, right? And apparently nothing unusual going on here. You've kind of proved it by the required preponderance of the evidence. Well, the big debate has come, if it's below 50%, what do you do? Well, then you can't use that argument. But we're going to say, well, still, for policy reasons, we're going to allow recovery for the value of the lost chance. Although it really is not the lost chance, because you can't recover unless the person actually died, right? You can't recover, because there was a lowered chance, but it didn't affect you, you survived, you get to recover for the lost chance. You can't do that. So what it really is a second best solution on liability. Saying, we know you can't prove causation, but we're going to, in this case, kind of say we're going to use the probability of causation for a second best solution of proportional recovery. But if you recognize that for below 50%, you should also recognize it for above 50%. And I think maybe it works that way in France. Maybe somebody can tell me later, but I think that in France, whether it's above or below 50%, it's just proportional recovery based on the probability of causation. So, again, I want to begin by saying, that the main point I'm trying to make is to kind of get clear what really is involved in proving actual causation in a specific case. I'm not trying to argue that when you can't prove it in a particular case, but when it may have existed, there isn't a good argument in some situations for nevertheless imposing liability, using something like proportional liability. I'm going to come back to that. Now, but before I do, I want to kind of talk more about these problem areas. And, you know, in the paradoxes, more than Jonathan Cohen talked about, if you interpret it as a pure probability standard, you take the Summers versus Tice sort of situation, the alternative causes. You know, one of these hunters, you know, shot the pellet into the victim's eye. We know one of them did, we don't know which one. And courts around the world say, well, in that sort of case, we clearly, here we really don't know which one caused it. The courts admit that we don't know which one caused it, but we'll allow you to hold them jointly and severally liable. We'll shift the burden of proof to them to prove they didn't cause it, and if they can't prove they didn't cause it, they're held fully liable, jointly and severally with contribution. And that's the result, I think, around the world. And by the way, this approach of how you handle cases when you really can't prove causation, but it may have happened, of reversing the burden of proof, I think is very, very typical in civil law countries, right? Much more than in common law countries. But in this particular situation, it kind of happens across the board. Now, that may sound good, but what if you have three hunters, right? If you have three hunters and you kind of said, you know, if you can prove that you were not the person that caused this, you're off the hook. If you have three hunters and they're all equally liable, each one of the hunters can prove by a 66 2/3% that it wasn't them, right? They're one of three. The odds are it was one of the other two. So if you kind of allow that sort of statistic to be kind of satisfy preponderance of the evidence, you know, all you have to do is show more likely than not it wasn't me. You satisfied your burden of persuasion, supposedly, of proving it wasn't you. And that means each one can prove they didn't do it, which means none of them did it, which is, of course, ridiculous. We know one of them did. So you had a paradox here, right? And I noticed the restatement third kind of rephrases it very carefully here, right? The restatement third, I don't know if I have it around me or not, kind of says that you've got to, in this case like this, show why it wasn't you, right? Show how it wasn't you. You've got to introduce particular evidence to kind of show it wasn't you, not just merely a statistic, right? And that's how you prove what actually happened or didn't happen, evidence particular this particular case. Now, if you go to the, maybe kind of one, you know, and by the way, sort of another example in the common law where it's very clear we don't use the odds is the distinction in evidence law between habit evidence and character evidence. We allow habit evidence that kind of says this happens all the time, right? This person always does this. Well, if they always do it, it's reasonable to infer they did it in this case. But if it's character evidence, most of the time they do this, a lot of the time they do this, that's not admissible to prove what happened in this case. You know, so again, that distinction, you know, is recognized. The area that I think is most problematic is one that a lot of countries don't have much problem with is res ipsa or prima facie evidence, right? I mean, res ipsa, the original case, Byrne versus Bodle in England, was not a problematic case because it was phrased as, if this would not have happened, right, absent negligence, then you can infer it must have been due to negligence. So the usual sort of criterion, if it would not have happened absent negligence, and by the way, some Texas cases phrase it this way, then it wouldn't have, then in this case, if it did happen, there must have been negligence. And the second kind of, you know, thing you have to establish is that you sufficiently eliminate other plausible sources of negligence. And I think this is meant in a concrete sort of story way again, right? You have to eliminate the other possible sources, so the only one left standing is the defendant as the person who caused this. And it was elaborated in the first and second restatement says, you know, exclusive management was just too strict and no voluntary contribution by plaintiff, which was too strict. But basically, plausibly eliminate, just not as a matter of odds, but as a matter of, you know, kind of filling in particular evidence in this sort of case, it wasn't them, not plausibly them, then, you know, enough to form a belief, eliminate them, that leaves the defendant standing here. But somehow that original formulation of res ipsa became shifted over the years from a sort of notion of even kind of what would not happen in ordinary circumstances to what ordinarily would not happen, what most of the time happens or does not happen. Well, that's using a probability assessment again. And we're now allowing you to kind of say that, you know, if most of the time when this happens is due to negligence, you can infer in this case it's due to negligence. So again, that's not a straightforward circumstantial evidence sort of issue, as people say. It's a dramatic policy decision to kind of say, we'll allow you to prove this based on what happened in this case, based on overall class-based statistics. Now, at least that was limited, I think, by the second condition in the first and second restatements of sufficiently related other possible causes. But I know that in the third restatement, you know, Mike and Bill interpreted that as being a probability also, and then kind of said from a mathematical probability standpoint, it doesn't make sense to multiply the two together. Let's combine it into one overall probability assessment. But that would again produce radically, non-common sense sort of results. I think the way it's stated in the third restatement now is, do I have it here somewhere? I don't think Mike has it memorized. Do you? That basically if, I thought I had it pulled out here. No. Oh, maybe it's here. The fact finder may infer the defendant has been negligent and you need to add in by bracket, and the negligence caused the accident. We're inferring negligence and causation. When the accident causing the plaintiff's physical harm is the type of accident that ordinarily happens as a result of the negligence of a class of actors of which the defendant is the relevant member. So if you're a member of a class that most of the time it's due to your negligence this sort of thing happens in this sort of circumstance, we can say, based purely on that statistic, that in this case, you did it and you were negligent. In a certain type of situation, most of the time the cause of the traffic accident here is a youthful male. Can we then kind of say, you're involved in an accident, you're a youthful male, therefore we can use this to kind of establish that you were the negligent cause of the accident? I don't think so. Now, so I think, you know, if you try and interpret these burdens of persuasion, which in the civil law is not done as far as I know, but in the common law generally is not done, only in a few areas, and only by this misinterpretation of preponderance of the evidence, more likely than not, balance of probability, as being a probability function, overall statistic, not a belief function. Well, so what do you do in these cases when you kind of say that we don't know the mechanics, we don't know the causal laws well enough, all we have are the statistics? I think in that case you have to acknowledge we don't know, like in the Hunter's cases, we really don't know whether it caused it or not. But that leaves open the question, what should we do? Should we say no liability? Or should we kind of say, let's adopt some sort of second best or third best solution as a matter of justice, right? And justice kind of says you kind of focus on the individual case, not the overall statistics, right? But you might still say in these sort of cases, and by the way, I think the easiest cases to argue for recovery anyway and liability is the one that's often criticized in the U.S. as being the most contrary to justice by people like Goldberg and Zapersky. It's the DES cases, right? Those sort of cases in which, and this is kind of the theory really of the original case in California and Sindel and the clearly the theory in Heimowitz and so forth, and saying that, you know, we really don't, and by the way, in the DES cases, I've seen it stated, I'm not sure if it's true or not, that it may well have been that Eli Lilly had more than half the market directly or indirectly, right? Well, if that's true, using this 50%+ thing, you could hold them liable in every case. The court in the Sen case in Oregon said the same thing true in the Sen case in Oregon. You have 70% of the DPT. If that's enough, we can hold you liable in every case. Even Judge Weinstein said that's something wrong there. You know, roughly 70% of these were yours. We just don't know which one. Roughly, you know, Eli Lilly, 55% of these are yours. We just don't know which one. But we know 100% of them weren't yours. We're going to hold you liable for every one of them. Something's gone wrong here. You know, so what do we do instead? We adopt proportional liability. We kind of say we're going to hold you liable in each case based on your share of the market. But it turns out in these mass exposure cases that ends up saying that really is the amount of damage roughly that you caused. And this is an argument made in Sindel, made in Heimowitz again. The strongest argument was that, you know, if we knew which ones were yours, we knew which 70% was yours, you'd pay 100% of the damages in that 70% of the cases. Well, instead, you're paying 70% of the damages in 100% of the cases. That's the same overall liability. It's not exact, but it's good enough, right? So in those cases in particular, there's really not much injustice in saying you're paying for the damages you actually caused. We haven't been able to line you up exactly with your, you know, with your victims, but that's the amount of damage you caused. And that's what you're be held liable for and nothing more. Now in Heimowitz, and the people, where people don't like Heimowitz, Heimowitz kind of said, well, if you can prove you didn't cause it, you're still liable for that share. But they had to do that to uphold this overall scheme, right? Now they kind of said, if the plaintiff can prove that you did cause it, he can get it all from you. So we're not going to sacrifice the first best resolution for the plaintiff to the second best scheme. But we're not going to have the second best scheme upset by saying you can avoid liability by proving you didn't cause this. That means you're not going to end up paying your overall fair share, right? But what about the cases where you are made to pay 100%? Well, a judge in Illinois in a dissenting opinion said what we should do in that case is allow you to bring a contribution action against the others, right? To kind of get it back down to your share. So those cases, to me, I think is a very strong justice argument in these cases of indeterminable causation for saying you should adopt proportional liability. And I think once you recognize you're able to do that, you may want to go back and reconsider these the hunting cases, right? In the hunting cases, I mean, the courts refused to extend Summers versus Tice hunting thing to mass exposure cases because it just too many cases you're being held liable for, right? So you may go back to the hunting case and kind of say, well, actually, rather than full joint and several liability, it's proportional liability, right? If it's two of you, it's half and half. Three of you, it's a third, a third, a third. You should say in the medical loss chance cases, we're basing it on probability of causation. There's a strong reason to do it in medical malpractice case. There is a contract, there's an expectation of care that wasn't taken. And for both justice and deterrence efficiency reasons, we should impose liability proportional to the loss, proportional to the probability of causation. You're not recovering for the lost chance. It's not a new legal injury. You're recovering in proportion to the probability of causation. And I think that's better than the what's usually adopted in the civil law countries is reversing the burden of proof, because that just shifts it all the other way. Reversing the burden of proof means that in a case of indeterminate causation, the defendant always loses, right? So if we should recognize instead in these cases, we don't know. We can't prove whether it caused it or not. And we might decide for reasons of justice in particular cases to say a second best solution is to hold you liable based on the probability of causation. But not to say you've proved causation, right? Even though the result may be the same, but it's not going to be if you get full liability. The result should be proportional liability. And we're admitting we don't know about causation. And instead, we're kind of saying as a matter of justice, we're going to adopt this other solution based on probability of causation and base liability on that. And that's it.
And now we're open the debate. Professor Hack.
Okay, could I start with what is in the present context a niggle? If this were a congress on metaphysics, it wouldn't be a niggle, but in this context it is. Okay, in this context this is a small point. In other contexts it would not be. I would not be inclined to follow Mill on the subject of what a law of nature is, because he is a kind of nominalist about laws, I think. He describes them as statements. And I take it that a statement of law is a statement about something in the world. Mm-hmm. And the law is the thing in the world, not right. Just the statement.
Right.
But in this context, that's a niggle. What I most want to do is to sort out, I agreed with something like 57.5% of what you said about proof and probability. And I'd kind of like to draw if you look up the word probable in the Oxford English Dictionary or in Webster's, they both say probable. It has two senses. One of which is mathematical, matter of frequencies of probability or propensity. And the other of which says it's a matter of degree of evidence or degree of proof or by evidence. I think the first move that should be made in the present context is to say, when we talk about the burden of proof, standard of proof, we're talking about probabilities in the second sense and not the first. Okay. That means that I wasn't comfortable when you talked about degrees of proof as degrees of belief. I mean, though there is psychological language in jury instructions and such, I think the basic idea is epistemological. It's how good is the evidence? Enough to meet this standard is okay. The reason that matters, besides, you know, sort of getting it epistemologically right, is most Bayesians these days are subjectivists about probability. So probabilities are simply degrees of belief, according to them. And that makes your position saying, look, the Bayesians are just off the wall, which I agree with, very hard to sustain if you're treating degrees of proof as degrees of belief. Because they're treating probabilities as degrees of belief. Mm. So you're opening the door to the very confusion that you want to avoid. Okay, and then with...
Let me just sort of, before I can remember that, and I think I agree with all of that, and I, in fact, in my original writings, I talked about what I'm now calling degrees of belief as ex post probabilities, but there's such a difficulty of getting people to think about probability in the second sense that you talk about and I agree with. And I meant to kind of say well-founded belief, because I don't believe it's any old belief. I meant to kind of say a well-founded belief using the sort of factors that you use, right? You know, in the sort of things I talked about. So it has to be not just a belief, but a well-founded belief in the kind of, you know, evidential support thing, area that you talk about. But my experience has been is to kind of talk about it as probability as all as I did originally. People keep coming back and kind of saying, you know, you're agreeing with the first part. I mean, they don't see the distinction, you know. So I'd rather kind of talk about it being a well-founded belief, you know, evidential-based belief rather than a probability, because talking about a probability seems to be impossible to get people to see what I'm talking about. It's a difference.
I think you've been trying to avoid one misunderstanding at the cost of risking another, which is equally dangerous.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then, as for this doubling of risk idea, you and I agree. It's a horrible misinterpretation of preponderance of the evidence. But I wanted to go back to Kaczynski on Dalbert on remand one more time. Mm-hmm. I promise this will be the last. I mean, one of the things that strikes me very forcibly about that ruling, well, actually, there are two. One is, he says quite firmly, California law requires a showing of at least a doubled risk. Well, California law requires nothing of the kind. Right. What it requires is proof by a preponderance of the evidence.
Exactly.
So that a misunderstanding has been built into this very statement of what California law requires.
It says, and the California Evidence Code actually says it is degrees of belief. You know, I mean, it's based on belief, you know, in the sort of sense we're talking about.
So it doesn't say what Kaczynski says it says. Right. But as soon as he said this, you see other courts saying, Washington law requires, Texas law requires, Florida law requires. None of them do,
right.
But it's the same misunderstanding which is now being carried across the courts like a kind of infection. It's really scary. And I think there was one thing that you didn't say, I'm sure you also believe, I just want to get explicit about this doubling of risk standard. I mean, I think it's desperately confused, right? But that aside, as policy, it's crazy. Because if that's the standard, once you've established there's more than a doubled risk, anybody who is exposed to the substance and developed the disorder will be able to recover. And that's crazy.
Right. The defense side likes it only because usually it means they're not liable, right? If it turns out that you had a lot of...
Yeah, if it turned out that it was more than doubled...
If it turns out that you had cases where, you know, very often it was more than doubled, the defense side would be screaming like crazy about that interpretation. Like I say, in the Oregon case, DPT, 73%, and even though the Oregon court mouthed this sort of, you know, 50% probability idea, they refused to kind of take that 73% and say, therefore, you're liable. They recognized, just like in the DES cases, that means you're liable in every case. Something's wrong here, right? And by the way, they also, one of the few courts that rejected even the Summers versus Tice approach, even though there's only two defendants.
By the way, I really like your analysis of probability. That clarified something that you might
That's all we're getting.
Well, thank you very much. That was really very interesting. Well, just first of all, one remark. As far as I know, there's no proportional liability in French law, at least not directly proportional. But then on your last, on that point you raised at the end.
I thought the medical malpractice loss chance things were proportional.
Well, if we have loss of chance, so in that sense, it can be considered as proportional. But you don't have proportional liability in cases where you have several potential tortfeasors.
Right, in that sense. Right.
But you're right. In medical malpractice's case, you have loss of chance in a way that actually, in my opinion, is not founded, is not good, but we do have that. When you said that reversal of the burden of proof was not the good solution and proportional liability would be better, for example, in Hunter's cases, in effect, typically in France, we also have those Hunter cases, which we sometimes solved through quite original ways, for example, using liability for things and common keeping of things, but the end result is the same. If you reverse the burden of proof, then each, well, let's say, potential tortfeasor can answer, well, they all answer severally and jointly and severally, but then you have contribution. So in the end, you have proportional liability, because if you have three hunters...
Yeah. If the other party is solvent and available.
Yeah, but that's a shifting of the risk of insolvency, and the risk lies on the hunters instead of the victim. But then that works where you have the same probability for all actors. Then in death cases, we've had a few ones. They're quite recent in France, a lot more recent than in the United States, but we had a few ones. And here's there we have a problem because... the Cour de Cassation held that the producers were jointly and severally liable. That's basically the solution. But in France, we actually had two producers, and one had 90% of the market, and the other one had 10%. So if you apply normal rules, then there will be contribution, and each one will have to pay for 50%. So that, of course, is problematic. But a solution could be... because it's based on reversal of the burden of proof, a solution would be, when it comes to contribution, then let's apply statistics. That's what I personally would prefer in the French context. So you could have, you know, proportional liability only at the contribution stage and not at the stage of the relation between the plaintiff and the tortfeasors. When it's proven that all tortfeasors indeed were, let's say, in breach of a duty of care.
Right. No, you know, I agree. Assuming that all the parties are available and solvent, it reaches the same result. It does have a little bit different impact in terms of who has to bear, you know, the cost of actually kind of suing each person and getting recovery. Underneath joint and several liability, the defendants who ends up paying the most has to kind of get, you know, prove the actions against the others and recover from them. Underneath proportionate several liability, the plaintiff has to kind of go after each one of them separately in order to get the full amount. And I think in a case where it really is a true joint and several liability case, they actually each were negligent and did contribute to an indivisible injury. It's quite clearly the best result is to say that burden should be on the defendant to try and collect from the rest. Each one is fully liable. But in a case where we kind of say we don't know which of you caused this here, and you know, and you've got 90% of the market and you've got 10%. It's not clear to me why it isn't better and fairer to say from the very beginning you should only hold, you know, the one with 10% liable for 10% and not put him to kind of having to kind of hope that the other guy is available and solvent and go to the expense of recovering it all from him. But, you know, these are policy decisions. But, you know, again, my main point, like a lot of my writing, is to kind of say, let's separate the policy decisions from, you know, truly what we mean when we talk about causation and how to prove it. You know, if we recognize we're making policy decisions here, if we recognize these are normative questions of what to do in cases of uncertainty about causation, we're likely to get a better resolution than if we kind of think somehow we're proving causation when we're not.
Professor Stapleton. it's working. It's a very on-off machine.
I control it from up here. If I like it, I'll turn it off.
You're gonna mute me. A very small point. I think you've misread Sienkiewicz, because Lord Dyson was very clear in his judgment where he said he thought it was quite plausible that the statistics that might be so overwhelming and such a good fit with the facts that he could form a belief sufficient to support. So I think Lord Dyson is not on your side on this. And in fact, I thought yesterday Susan said something that was sort of along those lines, that it might be that the evidence was so overwhelming that you could form a well-founded belief that it was caused by the oil or whatever. So I think there's when I listen to you, I get this almost religious position that you cannot possibly form a belief if it's only on numbers. But I can, like Lord Dyson, imagine a situation where I could do it if they're high enough. So that's to one side. That's really just my own religious position, I suppose. So we can't meet on that. The question I really want to ask is right at the beginning of the talk, when you're laying out your account of causation, and am I right that you've now retracted your account into simply natural causation? So you're not really speaking to all those mass tools that have got nothing to do with the world of physics and medicines and so on, but things to do with decision making, like investment decisions. So your account doesn't tell us anything about mass investor suits, for example, and how you prove causation in that.
No, I think, you know, again, that's just a whole other articles or books and stuff. And so I think that, you know, even I believe in terms of mental processes, they also follow natural laws. Again, we don't know them very well, right? But we kind of have to rely upon, again, particularistic evidence to try and figure out what we know and what we don't know. So I don't have a problem, unlike, you know, Hart and Honorio saying that that mental processes also, you know, follow causal laws. And the only problem comes up in cases when you're trying to figure out not so much, again, the initial causation, but what you do, what you talk about in your paper, you know, what you do in kind of cases where there is causation, but it would have happened anyway due to some sort of non-tortious condition, right? You know, and in that sort of area, just as in the area of trying to figure out damages, there you kind of have to do work on probabilities and so forth. But I think in terms of, you know, proving actual causation, it doesn't matter if it would have happened anyway due to something else. If this is what contributed to it, either duplicatively or preemptively, you've got the actual causation question answered. And if you want to say, well, you know, if this would have happened anyway due to the general economic circumstances, that doesn't mean this didn't contribute to it. What you're kind of saying is, as a matter of tort law, we're not going to allow recovery if, absent all tortious conduct, this would have happened anyway, because your situation hasn't been changed. Your situation in life hasn't been changed by tortious conduct. So from the justice standpoint, that's a correct position. Efficiency theorists wouldn't agree with that, by the way, but from a justice standpoint, that's a correct result.
No, that's not getting at what I'm getting at. What I'm getting at is you've got an investor's suit, right? When you've got lots of investors, they're each making a different decision, and you're not going to be able to do what you said you can do with natural laws. That is, you go out and you do your experiments and you keep dropping the stone from the tap. Eventually work out some basic laws, and then you look at the instantiation of that in the particular case and so on. This doesn't work when you're talking about things like people making a decision about whether to invest in Enron. These are you'll never be able to do the experiments. So it seems to me that you've got to give us something to hold on to when we're trying to deal with mass torts, when we're talking about people's decisions, and you can't go back. You'll never be able to find some fundamental laws that apply to that person or to that context. So it seems to me that when we get to these human behavioural contexts, you're not really giving us any information as to what causation in those contexts means. There are no causal laws that we could possibly ever discover. So how do we resolve this in the here and now in courtrooms?
Well, you know, again, we can have enough of an idea of I guess we have the same sort of idea. We kind of have this very indefinite causal generalization about given these sort of things, people, you know, tend to react in certain ways most of the time. Then you have to kind of say, what do we kind of have in this particular case, and the overall evidence we have, this is what really influenced this person in this case. It's not too hard to say in a lot of cases that this clearly was a factor in what they had to decide. Maybe it wasn't enough by itself, maybe it didn't make any kind of overall difference, but it clearly would be a factor that anybody thinking about it rationally would take into account, unless you have some contrary evidence that this person isn't rational or wouldn't take it into account.
So you see, this is the thing I don't understand, is that when you're now seeming to go out and say, well, sociologically, we think that most of the time people will take this into account. Isn't that a bit like the probability stuff? You know, aren't you going out and saying, well, 60% of the time people read the financial news before they invest, and therefore we're going to assume this individual did this? Isn't that the same stuff that you're criticizing Micah Jobber?
No. You know, again, that particular example I wouldn't agree with, but I think, for example, to infer that when somebody runs up and stabs somebody in the back with a knife that was their intent isn't too difficult to infer.
But come back to the investment decisions. The investment decisions are the ones that I'm pressing you on, and I'm not sure that you're going to be able to give me anything but the sort of sociological statistics to make your approach work.
I need to know the particular sort of case better, you know, but again, if it turns out that we don't have enough to know, I might kind of say that's the case where you have to kind of move to some sort of proportional sort of notion. I haven't written about that sort of area very much. I have written about decision cases, you know, and I say something about that in the emerging issues collection paper. I don't think that the basic nature of causation is all that different, and I think that that we have a very, you know, easy time sometimes and a very difficult time sometimes in other cases inferring what people's thought processes were. And if we have a difficult time, maybe we're kind of more in the area of kind of, I say, moving toward, you know, some sort of recognizing you really don't know. And I say that in the emerging issues paper. If we really kind of don't know how this person would have decided if given this information, but, you know, we may have a problem in terms of how we work out this particular case. You know, if they would have decided this way, it would have been but for causation. If they wouldn't have decided that way, then it would not have been. But all we have is maybe a probability of which way they would have gone. We have to kind of go on that probability in terms of, you know, of proportional liability, perhaps. I say that in the emerging issues paper.
Professor Karempas.
I can see the usefulness of analytically distinguishing between resolving the issue as a matter of causation or as a matter of policy and justice, despite the fact that we can't show causation. And I also share, I think, your general policy preference to proportional liability. So I have a couple of questions. First, I would like you to be clearer on if you have a theory of when proportional liability is acceptable or not as a policy decision. For example, in the naked statistic cases of the red bus, the yellow bus, would you support proportional liability? And if not, what is the difference from the Sindel line of cases? Because it seems to be a recurrent risk, a repeat player. So that's one thing. The other thing that I'm not clear enough is about the ways that you instantiate the causal law in the specific case. But you talked quite abstractly. I wonder, for example, if you take Sienkiewicz and you remove Section 3 of the Compensation Act, and let's reverse the numbers. So it would be more probable that the injury was as a result of the negligent defendant negligence than the background stats. So do you think that on the facts of Sienkiewicz there is a way to instantiate the risk, and if not, would you support proportional liability in that case? These are the main two questions. One, a smaller point.
I would support Barker.
You would support?
Barker versus Corus before the Section 3.
Okay. Also if it's more than 50%. Also if it's more than 50%.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. And the same things for the bus?
For the which?
For the bus example?
No, because, you know, the distinction is that, you know, what's going on, you know, in those cases, and it's why I have a problem really with res ipsa, the way it's formulated now and understood, is that the real power, and I think, you know, I think Jane is just going to talk about this in her paper, you know, the real power of the Hunter's sort of cases resolution is a second best set resolution is that in this case, we know each person was negligent. And may have caused this. And in the res ipsa case, we're trying to infer on probability basis negligence as well as causation. That seems to me that's a really huge different step, right? And I don't agree with that. And I think also that that's the case in these sort of, you know, naked statistics sort of cases, right? If it turns out that each one of them was negligent or tortious, however you define it, in Sindel or the DPT case and so on, and we're kind of saying that, you know, especially in a mass case, a certain number of these are yours. I don't have a big problem saying, you know, let's go ahead and hold you liable for a share of them, right? Or if there's a certain, you know, there's a certain probability that you were negligent and your negligence caused this, then, you know, proportional liability. I'm not saying in every situation. This is the most difficult problem, I think, if we move that way. How do you cabinet? But where I would draw the line is using, you know, is trying to impose liability on somebody when you can't even prove they were negligent or tortious.
And getting back to Sjankovic, you don't think that there is a way to instantiate?
Not based on existing knowledge, no.
Yeah. Okay, and just a small point of something that you said earlier. You know, you mentioned the duty breach, causation, damages, and 0.7. But it's a bit disingenuous because in the typical case, there would be uncertainty only about the causation, not about the existence of duty and negligence. It's true that in some medical cases, you wouldn't know whether the physician did A or B, and if it's A, it's negligent.
No. The trier of fact, whether it's a judge or jury, has to find each of those existed, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and maybe they only talk in an appellate case about one of them that's challenged, but they have to actually find that each one of those existed. And I think even if you do 0.9 times 0.9 times 0.9 times 0.9, you're below 50% pretty quickly.
Yeah, but again, the question of duty is normative. It's not a matter of whether it empirically exists 90% of the time or not. In negligence, again, in a typical medical negligence case, something the complicated one, it might be that, you know, you don't know if the physician perhaps he intubated, perhaps he didn't, and then there might be a matter of, and then if he didn't intubate, perhaps this is the cause and it's negligent, perhaps this is the cause or not. So in this case, you could multiply, but in the usual indeterminate causation case, you would know that he didn't intubate, so you would have the only thing that would be probabilistic was whether this is the cause of the result or not, like in Wilshire. You know what was going on there. The dispute is whether this is the result of the blindness or not.
That can be true in some and not true in others. And again, I think Cohen's point is that it's very clear, you know, whether it's one, two, three, or four that are at issue, we don't multiply probabilities. Mm-hmm. We focus on each element and kind of say, is this element satisfied? Is this element satisfied? Is this element satisfied? And we don't kind of say, you know, multiply those across and recognize from a mathematical probability standpoint, if you get enough of these loaded in here, you know, you have improved it.
Professor Green?
I'd like to stay with the point that you were just on. And we can only use that product rule with regard to multiple probabilities to find the combination probability when they're independent.
Right.
Right. And let me suggest to you that I think in a number of cases, they're not independent. Mm-hmm. So here's an example, in fact, where cause and liability are entirely dependent, right? And it's in a toxic case where causation is disputed. So if causation exists, there is liability for failure to warn. It follows, and the product rule that you were using is entirely inappropriate there, Richard. And I'm not sure, because I haven't thought it through entirely, but I think in res ipsa, it may be the case as well, that we're not talking about probabilities that are entirely independent. And if that's right, then your point we lose it. That is, in order to use your calculations, you need to show that they're independent.
Right.
Right? Okay, we agree on that.
Yeah, and by the way, when I kind of read the restatement third and you guys were making your argument about how you could multiply, I had the same sort of problem, that you guys are assuming they're independent.
I had the same sort of problem with that, too,
yeah.
I will say.
Yeah.
Let me say also about the hunters. I think in the United States today, although
we don't have cases
to demonstrate this,
I don't think we have joint several liability
in hunters.
Liability,
not on the probability of causation,
but
based on a comparison,
because we
largely don't have joint and several liability in the United States,
as you appreciate. Joint and several liability existed in Summers because that was the
background for multiple defendants.
The background for multiple defendants today is different, and therefore, I think.
Right, unless it's intentional or toxic, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
But what we don't have is that base of joint and several liability with regard to negligent tortfeasors who
it depends, are. Depends upon the state and economic versus non-economic, as you know. It's just a whole smorgasbord.
That would be the backdrop, whatever it is,
yes,
in a
exactly.
given jurisdiction
exactly.
that we would expect to be
exactly.
applied.
Exactly, right.
And finally, I want to ask you a question that goes to the first comment you made about science investigating. Specific.
No, I'm sorry. No, I don't want to
go back to that. That's exercise note 37 across the world forever,
going back
retroactively to the beginning. What I want to know, you said science would investigate
question
of specific causation, and I'm trying to figure out which scientific discipline
it is that would
investigate whether. My cancer was a result of some environmental exposure or was not. My question is, who's doing that?
I don't think I said that. I think I said that the scientific knowledge about causal laws we use to try and identify instance-specific causation. I agree. I agree with what you said yesterday in terms of what we kind of heard in Edinburgh about causative effects and effects of causes, that scientists in general, they're interested in learning the causal laws. They aren't interested in kind of particular cases. Now, it's not true of engineers, by the way. I mean, engineers, I don't know if you're a scientist or not, they want to know why this building collapsed, right? And doctors want to know what caused this particular thing, although they often are satisfied enough with just a general probability in terms of diagnosis the best they can do, right? But if they had more specific information, they would sure like to know. But people that have to worry about specific cases have to apply our general knowledge of causal laws that science gives us. So my point was that we cannot begin to identify specific instances of causation without the knowledge that scientists give us about causal laws.
Just with regard to doctors, and them being interested in the cause of some disease, only when it has clinical implications for
exactly.
treatment. So
exactly.
an allergist might, but an oncologist doesn't care.
Hmm. Well, he would if we knew more about the processes, he would care. He'd want to know exactly what he should try and do in this particular case. The more information you have about how this process of cancer works, the more you want to know it. You'd like to know that in this particular case to treat this particular condition.
If it had clinical implications.
Yes, exactly. No, I agree that in general, as a general matter, scientists are interested in learning the laws, and they aren't really interested in applying them in particular cases. I agree with that.
Okay, if there are no more questions, we can go for a coffee and meet again at 12. Thank you.